Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Medical Monday, March 18th. I'm Ray Graff. Support comes from Hudson Dental Arts, providing all on 4-at implants, a new technology that strives to restore smiles in a single day procedure. HudsonDentist.com. Joining us for Medical Monday is Dr. Laura Twist, an OBGYN with New Vance Health. She provides comprehensive women's health care through pregnancy, office-based gynecology, and gynecologic surgery, including minimally invasive surgery and robotics. If you have a question for Dr. Twist, give us a call now. 800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. Or feel free to email us at voxpop@wamc.org. We'll meet Dr. Laura Twist and take your calls coming up. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Joining us for Medical Monday today is Dr. Laura Twist. Dr. Twist is a board-certified obstetrician-gynecologist for New Vance Health, working primarily out of Putnam Hospital. She provides comprehensive women's health care through pregnancy, office-based gynecology, and gynecologic surgery, including minimally invasive surgery and robotics. Dr. Twist earned her medical degree from Louisiana State University School of Medicine in New Orleans and completed her residency in OBGYN from SUNY Downstate Medical Center in Brooklyn, New York. Got a question for Dr. Twist? Give us a call, 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. Feel free to email, if you prefer that route, voxpop@wamc.org, voxpop@wamc.org, or 800-348-2551. Dr. Laura Twist, welcome to the show.
Hi, Ray. Thank you so much for having me.
Before we start, let me just say that Laura Twist is probably the coolest name in all of gynecology, yeah?
It's not a bad one. I like it a lot. It's pretty easy for patients and easy for me.
It's a good radio name, too. Yeah, do they call you LT?
I call myself LT a lot, yes.
How did you end up in this neck of the woods?
So I actually grew up in southern Westchester. My husband grew up in Long Island, and we had gone to college together in Washington, D.C., and then medical school down in New Orleans, as you just mentioned. And I did residency up at, well, down from here at SUNY Downstate in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
And just as I was wrapping up residency, we had our first child, Charlotte. She's 7 now. And Brendan was finishing his graduate degree at CUNY Hunter. He's a social worker. And we were like, the world is our oyster. Where do we go next? We just finished this grueling training, graduate school. Where do we want to be? And so we looked west. We moved out to Montana.
Which
we practiced.
Is cool.
Yeah, it was pretty great. Pretty wonderful place to raise little kids. And I practiced out there for 6 years. It was really wonderful at a community hospital in Butte, Montana. And then just this summer, decided to move back east. 3 kids later, be closer to aunts, uncles, cousins. You know, everybody's back here. So here we are.
Do they still have the big open copper mine in Butte, Montana?
They sure do.
It's so enormous.
Yes,
it's incredible.
It's very famous.
Well, good to have you back east here. Dr. Laura
Thank
Twist
you.
Is our guest, board-certified OBGYN for New Vance Health. And if you have a question, give us a call at 800-348-2551. You mentioned you had a couple of kids, 3 kids, right?
Yes, we do.
Isn't it wonderful what you do? You bring life into the world. Isn't that just a fabulous thing?
Yes, it's wonderful. I think that entering the labor and delivery unit at the hospital is like one of the only times people are actually happy to show up at the hospital, right?
Yeah.
You come to the ER or surgery, maybe you're going to be relieved after you get a knee replacement or hip replacement or something, but labor and delivery, people are usually a little nervous, but very excited. And it's usually a really, really happy place to work.
Have there been we've been given birth as a human race for a long, long time. But in the past 10, 20 years, I've seen so many advancements in technology and in science in so many fields of medicine. Is there anything radically different than when you were first starting out in medical school?
On the obstetric side, I wouldn't say there's too many differences. I think there certainly has been a worthwhile push towards listening to our patients more, which I like. I think,
why is that important?
Well, there used to be a very paternalistic model of medicine where, like, the doctor told you what to do, you didn't question it, there wasn't too much back and forth. But I think now there's acceptably and encouraged to have more of a discussion with your provider and to really, well, I at least want to try to think about the whole person, what's going on with them, what their goals are in their medical care, but, you know, especially in a birth, which can be like a pretty stressful, but also like very special and private moment that we're invited to be part of. Yes, as you said, people have been giving birth in fields, in beds, in their homes since the beginning of time. And we're just here to facilitate a process that's probably going to happen smoothly and easily on its own anyway.
Dr. Laura Twist is our guest today, an OBGYN, or OB-GYN, if you will. What, how do you say it?
OBGYN.
Yeah, that's what I do, too. Dr. Twist is with New Vance Health, Putnam Hospital. The number is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. You know, many a doctor on this program, and you're from downstate, you may not have heard it, but every Monday is Medical Monday, basically. Mm-hmm. So a lot of them say the same thing you just said. You know, one of the things that has changed is we listen more to our patients. Ultimately, unless you're Dr. Laura Twist about to give birth, you know a lot more than your patient. It can't really be a two-way conversation here.
Sure. I mean, the patient certainly knows more about their moment-to-moment body, right? Like, they know more about their body. They've been in it their whole lives. I might be meeting them for the first time in the office, and they're telling me about pelvic pain, or, you know, their periods have changed all of a sudden. It's been one way for 25 years. Suddenly they're shorter or longer, whatever. And so they're going to know that side of it. I might know, be running through possible diagnoses or possible workup or next steps or treatments in my head, but they can tell the story of what's going on much better than I can guess it.
You know, we were talking in the green room briefly before the show, and you had mentioned that the PAP schedule has
yes.
changed a little bit. And this is not an uncommon thing throughout medicine. A lot of these checks.
Screening tests.
Screening, you know, for breast cancer or colon cancer or whatever. The ages change. And mm-hmm. they'll go up, they'll go down over the course of years. What's going on with PAP?
So the PAP test is a screening test for cervix cancer. We might think it is certainly sort of invasive, but it is accessible. The cervix is accessible, so we can do screening for cervical cancer with like a little brush. We do cervical cytology, get cells off of the cervix, send them to the lab, and they tell us normal, slightly abnormal, maybe cancerous, God forbid. And so traditionally or historically, the guideline was to do PAP testing every single year, usually starting when you were 16 or when you became sexually active. And as we've learned more about HPV, human papillomavirus, that mediates cervical cancer, we have understood that it's a very slowly progressive disease. You can have HPV and clear it, and especially in younger women, that's pretty common. So now we start at age 21, and PAP testing happens every 3 years, 3 to 5, depending on which type of test you have done. But I've noticed certainly in New York, a lot of women still continue to have it every year. Most insurances will pay for that if that's what you prefer. But I certainly get people in the office apologizing that they have fallen behind. And I'm like, oh, no, you're still okay on that guideline.
Now, during the pandemic, you were out in Montana, yeah?
I was, yeah. We were in Montana from 2017 just until this last July.
Well, I don't know how it was in Montana. I can't believe it would be any more shut down than New York was.
No.
Or this or Massachusetts or any of these states. But, you know, a lot of people got way behind on a lot of things,
yes.
a lot. And there are still backlogs
Absolutely.
Of people trying to get appointments. Montana, and we'll hit the phones momentarily, I promise. But just for my own edification, was Montana much more sort of as normal?
Well, Montana has some built-in social distancing aspects to it.
Really?
You know, just life out there is a little more spaced out than. So I don't think we felt the crunch of COVID restrictions and kind of limitations as much as the East Coast did, for sure. But everywhere, I think there was kind of a lull in people doing preventative medicine. Things happened only if they were like urgent, emergent, and we didn't do as many preventative things. I was actually our director of the Department of Surgery, like the chair of the surgery department out in Montana, right during COVID. And it was really unpleasant because having to make decisions about which surgeries were urgent, emergent presents itself, right? But what had to happen, what was a good use of our resources, what could wait? I mean, you don't want to make people wait for surgeries. Very few things, nobody should be doing unindicated surgeries. Things aren't really elective. So just having to decide how many we could do in a day, how we were going to staff rooms, what if everybody got exposed, you know, or the whole OR crew. So yeah, that was a lot.
Well, God bless your entire profession for for being so tough and being there all the time, even though it was scary for all of us. So thank you for that. Dr. Laura Twist is our guest today. It's OBGYN on Medical Monday. One more question, and then we'll take a break, and then we'll hit the phones. 800-348-2551 is the number if you will have a question for Dr. Twist. 800-348-2551 or email voxpop@wamc.org. So on your video, when you join Nuvance Health, they made a little couple-minute video, and I watched it today. It's very nice. What's the Da Vinci robot? Tell me about that, and how's that changed your game?
Oh, yeah. So you mentioned advances in obstetrics, and maybe not too many, but in gynecology, certainly in surgical practice, there have been some big changes, big push towards minimally invasive surgery, where maybe on the inside of someone's body, we're kind of doing the exact same things, but the incisions can be much smaller, which means less blood loss, like shorter recovery. Sometimes you go home same day, like from a hysterectomy or something that historically might have meant like a big hospitalization and a big recuperation. Da Vinci is the Intuitive is the brand that makes the Da Vinci robot that we use for some minimally invasive surgeries. It's pretty cool. So you dock the robot onto the patient using little laparoscopic ports, 8-millimeter laparoscopic ports. And then in the same room, there's a surgeon's console. So after everything's set up, I take off my scrub gown and go sit at the console. And it's, not to minimize it, but it's sort of like a video game. Like my hands are in these little devices and I can use the scissors or the clamps or the cautery and move the camera around and see the inside of someone's body, which is pretty amazing.
Why is that a game changer to some extent? Why is that an improvement over Dr. Twist using her hands?
Traditional laparoscopy, like traditional minimally invasive surgeries, laparoscopy, straight stick laparoscopy, we call it, where you have maybe a 30 or 40 centimeter stick with scissors at the end, tiny scissors at the end. And so you're standing at the patient bedside using these instruments and you're sort of limited in how much you can move. They don't rotate. But with the robot, you have the arms inside the patient and then the wrists and hands of the robot can articulate. And so when you're trying to get around an organ that's round, the uterus or ovaries or something like that, it's very helpful to have a device that can rotate and change angles. And the optics are really impressive. It has like binocular vision, right? So because my head is in like a little virtual reality thing. But so it's really handy and it's great for a lot of GYN surgeries. And a lot of general surgeons use them too for different things. But
all right. Now I'm not going to ask your age, but you're pretty young. You're the generation that played video games as kids. Do you think that helped you?
So I didn't play many video games. I did. I was very good at the claw machine as a child.
I remember that thing.
Yeah. My mom thinks it's hilarious. She was like, you either were going to be like a construction worker or I guess do robotic surgery. I used to like get kicked out of Five and Dime store
because
in the town
get
where I grew up, because I would just like put in a quarter and I would just get every single toy.
Gosh. You know, I got it once for one of my kids and I thought, oh, I'm father of the year because they're a scam. There's not too many things that are further apart than construction worker and gynecologist. Just saying.
Yeah, something about, I don't know, spatial movement. I don't know.
All right, let's take a break and then we'll hit the phones. 800-348-2551 is our number. OBGYN Dr. Laura Twist of Nuvance Health is here. We'll get to your calls coming up. Billy May, Hernando's Hideaway on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551 is the number. It's a Medical Monday. It's not a music show. Dr. Laura Twist is our guest from Putnam Hospital and Nuvance Health. You ready for some calls?
Sure, sure.
All right, let's go to Milan, New York. Lisa, you're on.
Yes, hi, Dr. Twist. I was wondering if there's a less painful way to check for uterine fibroids than the traditional inspection by the doctor. Can one get a sonogram or some other test?
Yeah, that's a great question. So fibroids, if people don't know, are the very common. It is a benign, we say tumor, but it's a muscle growth in the uterine wall. And they can have varying degrees of symptoms and sometimes are as large as a cantaloupe and sometimes they're the size of a marble. But traditionally, to check for fibroids, you can either do have a bimanual exam, it's called, done by your physician, where you're actually feeling the shape of the uterus. And I think that's what Lisa's saying is rather unpleasant. But we also can absolutely do an ultrasound. Ultrasound, I'd say, is like the preferred modality to look at our GYN organs because it gives you like a real-time picture as opposed to like a CT scan or an X-ray where it's almost like just a single photo shot. So with an ultrasound, you have your tech who can look at the ovaries, look at blood flow to the ovaries, look at the uterus, and then any fibroids that might be there. Absolutely.
Lisa.
Very helpful. Thank you so much. I'll schedule them now.
Perfect.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Ultrasound, obviously, it's sound and it's ultra. I assume it's a very high frequency. Is there anything you miss when you're doing an ultrasound that you might get from the old, less comfortable way of doing that?
Well, one thing that's really hard to diagnose in general from a clinical exam or imaging is endometriosis. Endometriosis tends to cause pelvic pain and pain with periods. But there are these small implants inside the pelvis. And so any kind of, sometimes people think, oh, maybe an ultrasound, maybe even an MRI, which is like the best kind of pelvic imaging, right? Gives us the best picture. Maybe those will pick it up and diagnose it, but there's really not a great way. On physical exam, maybe a better shot at feeling nodules from endometriosis implants or something like that, or tenderness of the uterus.
Are there any negative effects from the frequencies of ultrasound that they've been able to find in all these years they've
been
doing those?
None that we know of in all these years. We have patients through pregnancy, you know, you get multiple ultrasounds, especially if you're a more high-risk patient, you might even be getting them twice a week towards the end of pregnancy. And we haven't seen effects on babies or moms. It's very safe.
And it's so exciting for the parents to see the ultrasounds yes. as the pregnancy goes along. Dr. Laura Twist is our guest today. It's OBGYN on Medical Monday. 800-348-2551 is the number. Michael's in Washington, Massachusetts. Michael, you're on.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. Both my parents were physicians as I was growing up, and my mom always felt that the greatest specialty of all was to be an obstetrician because you had a happy family with a baby at the end of it. And I'm just wondering if you feel that way about your specialty, or if current politics has made it more problematic.
I think that obstetrics and gynecology is a fantastic field. It takes a couple of different shapes now than what it did years ago. Even when I was out in Montana, there was much more of like a community doc model. I took a lot of call, but call was taken from home. You know, I went in when my patients came in. And now there's more of a model where you have kind of shared call pools. I think that there's been an effort to find a little bit more work-life balance for the physicians, for better or worse. But I think for kind of sustainability of the field of your job, it's important for those docs. But there even are some OBGYNs who don't do the obstetrics part of it at all, who just like doing the kind of office-based gynecology or just GYN surgeries. And I think for like a young medical student, there's a lot of questions along the way where you kind of decide what you do or don't like about a given specialty. But I think OBGYN is a fabulous field.
Michael, thanks for the call. Dr. Laura Twist is our guest today. 800-348-2551 is the number. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. Are more women having C-sections now than they used to?
In the U.S., our C-section rate is pretty high. It's something that every hospital really tries to focus on, how to get below, you know, 30%, 27%, 25%. There's going to be some percentage of pregnancies that end in a cesarean delivery despite all of our best efforts, right? We don't deliver breech babies vaginally in the U.S. typically. Often, like, triplets are going to be C-sections, you know, twins usually are, or sometimes are. But I think that, yeah, we do have, because of like continuous fetal monitoring, and we're pretty risk averse as a people.
Is the C-section to some extent a, not a vanity surgery, but is it one that is not strictly necessary in a lot of the patients?
I don't think there are many physicians who are trying to do C-sections when they're not necessary.
I didn't say physicians. I mean patients. Would they request one?
Oh, it's pretty uncommon, I think.
Really? They'd rather go the old-fashioned way?
To have somebody say, I just want a primary C-section, just I don't want to push.
Yeah.
For kind of no other reason.
Now, you mentioned the breech. So the breech is when the baby is upside down or backwards or...
Butt first.
Butt first, yes. Yes. I know somebody who had that happen.
Yes.
And... the doc in the office said, okay, and laid hands upon...
I'm going to flip this baby.
And did it.
Yeah.
It was incredible.
Yeah,
how do you do that?
So maybe 3% of babies are breech at the time of delivery. You know, if you think of a baby, well, if you think of an adult, our head is like 1/7 of our body size, but for a baby, it's like 1/3.
Yeah.
Their head should be the widest, biggest part of their body. And so we want them to come head first, right? Because if the head fits... hopefully everything else will fit.
Right.
Rarely, occasionally, a shoulder gets stuck, but usually head first. Feet first or butt first, hips first, the head might get stuck. And that is a real disaster, head entrapment. Nobody wants that.
Right.
But what you're describing is called an external cephalic version. And that's, yes, laying on of hands, actually figuring out where that baby is in the belly, and then pushing, flipping, rotating the baby, trying to flip them to head down. And so that's absolutely something we do, usually around 36, 37 weeks if the baby is breech at that point.
How often is that successful?
50% to 75% of the time.
That's awesome. What a cool trick. I wonder who came up with that first.
Yeah. Well, probably someone who didn't have a C-section capability was like, this is my only option. You know?
Dr. Laura Twist is our guest today from New Vance Health. 800-348-2551 is the number. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. Let's grab a couple of emails here. This is from Christine. Could you speak about pelvic floor reconstruction for women over 80 years of age? Thank you. And that's from Christine in Kingston.
Yeah, so I do a fair bit of pelvic surgery. So it's often done for prolapse or sometimes incontinence issues. Prolapse is when the pelvic organs, like the bladder, the rectum, the uterus, try to escape from the pelvis, right, and come out through the path of least resistance, which is a vaginal opening. It can be very uncomfortable. It can lead to issues with emptying the bladder or emptying the bowels. And so about 50% of women will have prolapse when they hit their 60s or 70s, and about half of those women will have surgical correction of their prolapse, of their pelvic floor issues. And there are non-surgical options. Certainly you can do pelvic floor physical therapy, which is becoming more and more widespread. It's fantastic. Usually very good people who become pelvic floor physical therapists. Some of like the nicest women I've met. We can use pessaries, which if you want to Google ancient pessary, they've been around since the beginning of time. That's a device to help hold up the pelvic organs you place in the vagina to help hold up the pelvic organs. But pelvic floor reconstructive surgery is sort of like the definitive management of prolapse. And that can, the type of surgery can depend on the type of prolapse. So you can do like a bladder lift, I call it, or it's called an anterior colporrhaphy or posterior repair, or a hysterectomy with like an internal suspension. So you can call that a sacrocolpopexy or a uterosacral ligament suspension. I'm just saying all the
fancy
words.
It's easy for you to say.
It's just because it's my day-to-day life.
All right, fair enough. Eileen also writes in about pelvic floor disorders, who says, I've recently been told I should have a procedure to secure my cervix with a mesh. Also have a partial hysterectomy through laparoscopy. Is that correct? Is this something you do or do you refer others for that? I've been doing physical therapy for Kegel strengthening, but seems that this surgery now makes sense. I'm in my late 60s. I'd like to keep my ovaries. What do you think about that? Do you believe keeping ovaries makes sense? And that's from Eileen in the 845.
Okay, so there's a couple of questions there.
Yeah, I'll keep it open.
Thank you. So the mesh approach to pelvic floor repair really should only speak to a sacrocolpopexy. There previously was a trend of using vaginal mesh for prolapse. It's not the worst idea, but someone said, hey, you know how you can get a hernia at your belly button and that kind of bulges out? well, what if we put that same mesh in the vagina and help things from bulging out? But it's a different world, your belly button and your vaginal tissue.
Yeah.
So it had some complications, mesh erosions, you know, the mesh would kind of stick out, cause bleeding, cause pain.
You see the ambulance chaser ad still late
yes,
at night.
Yes. Yeah. So that has certainly fallen out of favor. But a sacrocolpopexy is internal mesh. It's like a Y-shaped mesh that helps to kind of hike things up from inside like suspenders. I personally don't do those surgeries just because I had very limited training in them. The best surgical approach is the one that your surgeon's the most comfortable with, right? But you should find the surgeon that does what you want.
Right.
Usually it would be a urogynecologist. So that's somebody who doesn't deliver babies. They don't manage birth control. They don't do IUDs. They just deal with pelvic floor and bladder disorders for women. And so that's someone who would absolutely do a sacrocolpopexy.
Our guest is Dr. Laura Twist from Putnam Hospital, New Vance Health. 800-348-2551 is the number. 800-348-2551. Let's go back to the phones. And it looks like it's Joan in Greenwich, New York. Joan, you're on.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, Joan.
Hello.
Hello.
Okay, I need to turn the volume up because I'm not hearing you.
Oh, don't
Sorry.
Turn the radio up, though. That would be bad.
No. The radio is off, Ray.
Oh, I'm sorry. All right. Go ahead, Joan.
Okay, so I'm 73 years old.
Okay.
And I have a question about pap smears.
Yes, please.
And I just want to give you a little background. My mom took DES mm-hmm. While she was pregnant with me. And so I was fairly carefully monitored, mm-hmm. Decades ago. And I don't know if this is relevant at all. I had a uterine fibroid a little over 30 years ago. And it had gotten to the point where my right ovary and my appendix had to be removed along with it. My current provider doesn't really think I need frequent pap smears, doesn't think that the cancers that sometimes resulted from DES are a concern at this point, and I would just like your opinion.
Sure. So, a couple of things. One, you had said just in general about pap testing, you're 73. There is a guideline that you can discontinue pap testing after 65 if you have 10 years of normal paps preceding that, and you have to have had at least 3 paps during that 10 years. You can't say, you know, I have 10 years of normal paps, but I haven't had any. So that's just for the general population. Personally, like, I am very risk averse. I believe in screening, and I like kind of just having the data and reassurance, like, hey, everything's normal. So I certainly am in favor of continuing pap testing as long as the patient is game for it. I think that if you have a risk factor like DES exposure or if you're immunocompromised in some way, like with HIV or something like that, then annual pap screening, or if you're just anxious about it, then annual pap screening is incredibly reasonable. And your insurance likely will cover it, even if you don't have the risk factor. It is less and less likely that you're going to develop cervical cancer or dysplasia, which means precancerous cells, as we get older and continue to have normal and HPV negative paps. It's less likely that you're going to all of a sudden have these abnormal cells. But if it's reassuring to be screened and have those negative results, then I think that's something that you can certainly advocate for.
Joan.
And how often would you recommend doing this? And I want to be clear, my provider didn't say don't do this.
Right.
She was perfectly willing to do it. She just didn't think it was necessary to do it, you know, as often as in the past.
Yes. So previously the guideline for PAPs was every year. Now we have sort of spaced it out to every 3 to 5 years. I think that like the 3-year time interval is reasonable for what we know about how HPV progresses and infects.
All right, Joan.
Okay.
Okay.
Thanks a lot for the call. 800-348-2551. Dr. Laura Twist is our guest today. And we'll do one more and then we'll take a break. We'll go to Matamoras, Pennsylvania. Jim, you're on.
What are the indications for an episiotomy and what bearing does it have on future childbirth?
Okay.
You got it, Jim. So an episiotomy is when you make an intentional cut, like into the perineal tissue, so the tissue between the vaginal opening and your bottom, which honestly tends to tear, especially at a first delivery. But an episiotomy is an intentional cut, usually made with scissors by the physician, hopefully with some anesthetic in place. The episiotomy should be used, an indication for use would be for an outlet obstruction, basically, like the baby's head is right there and they're having like literally a soft tissue obstruction that's preventing expeditious delivery of the baby. They're not very commonly done because as long as the baby, you know, we have this very fancy fetal heart monitoring that we can do now, either externally through mom's belly or we can put a little clip on the baby's head to monitor their heart rate. And we know that certain features of the heart rate monitoring indicate that the baby is well perfused, oxygenated, and doing well. So as long as we have those signs, we can sit there and watch the baby take their time,
yeah,
make their way out millimeter by millimeter. But if there were signs of distress and you're making a decision, hey, it'll be faster for me to make a cut and get this baby out this way, that's really the indication for an episiotomy. And it really shouldn't have any impact on the baby's health. I mean, the idea is to deliver them quickly so that they're healthy and well.
Now, first babies, the labor's usually longer, yeah?
Yes, especially the pushing phase tends to be longer. I think second babies tend to fling out. They come quickly, fast and furious, like a rocket ship.
Let's take a break. 800-348-2551 is our number. Dr. Laura Twist is our guest. We'll be back. Vox Pop, it's a Medical Monday. Ray Graff with you at 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551 is the number. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. All right, one of the recurring themes on Medical Monday is that people will write in things, big medical terms or pharmaceutical terms that I can't pronounce well. So here comes another one. This one's from Nell. What are the advantages / disadvantages of continuing HRT, estradiol patch plus oral progesterone after menopause? I have osteopenia, almost osteoporosis. I'm 68, have been on HRT since age 56. I have recently reduced my patch to 0.025, and that's from Nell.
Great.
I don't know what I read.
HRT is hormone replacement therapy.
Okay.
So that is a type of hormone treatment that's used in like postmenopausal women typically, or somebody who's gone through menopause early for whatever reason, Turner syndrome, early ovarian insufficiency. And so then we're replacing the hormones, estrogen, estradiol, and progesterone that they no longer have. And this can be given in a lot of different ways. And the rule of thumb is really what's the lowest dose that you need to control symptoms. HRT is interesting because it's not like blood pressure management or cholesterol. There's not like, if it's this number, then we give you this much, or this is the goal. It's really about your own personal symptoms. And so this is where it is important to like talk to your doctor, talk to your OBGYN or your primary care doctor, whoever's managing it for you, and make sure they understand how your daily life is affected by your menopausal symptoms, whether that's vaginal dryness, hot flashes, night sweats, sleep disturbance, mood changes, whatever. The first thing was a big trend towards giving everybody estrogen. People just like gobbled up estrogen everywhere. It was delicious. It made your skin nice. It gave you energy. You felt great. And then we saw all these people getting blood clots and uterine cancer, and it was not great.
No.
So then there was a huge push away from HRT, which sort of, unfortunately, I think resulted in a lot of people suffering from menopausal transition symptoms more than they needed to. Now we know that, especially in the first 10 years after menopause, so if you go through, average age of menopause is 51. If you're on hormone replacement therapy in your 50s, very safe to use. And again, just being mindful of like, what's the lowest dose I actually need? So the fact that this listener said that they're now on this 0.025 estradiol patch, great. Yes. And you try to kind of keep titrating down every year or so. I try to encourage my patients like, hey, do we still need this medication? It does. Certainly, we know that estrogen replacement or lack of estrogen replacement affects our heart health, brain health, and bone health. So then replacing our estrogen is helpful. If you have a uterus in your body, so if you're talking to your friend and you both use HRT, and yours is estrogen and progesterone, like our listener, and your friend is using only estrogen, it means that they don't have a uterus.
Oh, interesting.
So if you use unopposed estrogen, you're like feeding the uterus. And so we worry about endometrial or uterine cancer. So the progesterone balances that. But if you've had a hysterectomy, you don't have a uterus anymore, then we don't have to worry about that. So that's if you're talking to your friends and you're like, why are we on different regimens? That's it.
Dr. Laura Twist is our guest. Let me ask you a question before we get to the next call. And look, I'll never have to go through menopause. All right. That's one. That's the creator or evolution or whatever said, all right, you don't have to do that. What's with the hot flashes? What, in an evolutionary sense, why are they there? And why are they such a pain in the backside for so many women?
I don't know. I think, people didn't used to live so long.
Maybe.
No. As our estrogen levels drop off as we age, you have this like vasomotor reaction that menopause is so different for so many people. Some women look at a clock and they're like, oh, look, 12 months went by. Who knew? So menopause is defined. It's 12 months without any period or bleeding. And a lot of times periods are a little skip and hop towards the last couple of years. But they some people really struggle. Like 2 years, 10 years of this kind of roller coaster of I have a couple of regular periods and then I go through a couple months of hot flashes, sleep disturbance, night sweats, wild mood changes. I'm not sure from like an evolutionary standpoint or a physiologic standpoint why this happens to us.
It seems an unfair trick.
It's not that nice.
It seems carrying a child to term and then giving birth is a lot of work.
Yeah,
and even even in the best of times, it can be uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And then you get the hot flashes.
It's interesting because after delivery, you're pregnant, your hormones are screaming high, and then you deliver the baby, the placenta, and your hormones really do wash out.
Yeah.
And so a lot of women don't realize, but it's very normal in the 6 or even 12 weeks after a delivery to kind of have menopausal symptoms, to wake up with like night sweats and hot flashes and little mood swings here and there. There's also, an incredible sleep deprivation that occurs.
Yeah.
But it's not uncommon at all, and a lot of people are kind of freaked out by it. Like, why did I wake up soaking wet? And I'm like, oh, because all your estrogen is gone.
Amazing. All right, let's go back to our phone lines. Dr. Laura Twist is our guest today. It's OBGYN on the program. And we will go to Amanda in Warrensburg. Amanda, you're on.
Hi there.
Hi,
Amanda.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Indeed.
I had a question about finding an OBGYN that listens to women's needs. A lot of women have issues during menstruation, and I just feel like we're not taken seriously.
Sure. It's hard to screen a doctor before you meet them. Now in our internet age, you can go on and read reviews of physicians. I think that a number of the patients I've gotten in New York, they're saying, oh, we read your reviews online. And I'm like, from Montana, they can read the reviews from my prior practice. But
yeah.
That's probably your best bet, or word of mouth referral from a pediatrician or a primary care doc who you have an established relationship with and know, for them to tell you someone who they think might be a good fit. It's hard. I think that with a therapist, with a physician, you shouldn't have to work that hard at the relationship, And if you do, then I would be motivated to find somebody else.
Yeah, Amanda.
Yeah, I agree completely. I feel like we shouldn't have to work that hard to get the care that we need.
Yeah.
And a lot of times we're kind of told that these symptoms are normal when in reality they are signs of, like you were saying before, endometriosis. It's very hard to diagnose without all of these tests.
Yes.
And they could very easily be symptoms of something else like endometriosis.
Absolutely. I think that it's hard to advocate for yourself, sometimes, especially in the medical field where there is sometimes a knowledge discrepancy between how well you know your body, but then what I know about gynecology. But I think that you're it sounds like you're on the right path here where you're willing to advocate for yourself, which is good. That's a first step.
Well, Amanda, thanks for the call. Dr. Laura Twist is our guest. from Putnam Hospital at New Vance Health. 800-348-2551 is our number. 800-348-2551. You always see those doctors. If you search a doctor, you see the reviews. That's a double-edged sword, big
sure,
time. Because,
sure.
I mean, who do you hear from most? The people who are angry,
yes,
or dissatisfied. It's,
mm-hmm,
it's a skewed result.
ER doctors have the worst reviews on the planet. But nobody wants to, you know, nobody's happy walking into the ER. And that's just kind of part of it. I mean, when you're looking at them, I almost hate to, like, bring up reviews, right? But when you're looking around, take that with a grain of salt, that you're like, the unhappy people are going to be the loudest. But if I can pick some things out of here that tell me, hey, this person listens, they run on time if you're lucky. You
yeah.
know?
Well, you know, it's that way with any profession, whether yeah. it's a restaurant or even radio station. Most of the people we hear from are the ones who are, boy, that Ray's an idiot, you know, or something, you know, disliking something. That's what happens.
Yeah.
Most people who are fine, they just go with the flow. And mm-hmm. speaking of going with the flow, let's go to Betsy in Warwick. Betsy, you're on with Dr. Laura Twist.
Oh, hi there.
Hi, Betsy.
Yeah, I was just curious. For a rectal prolapse, would mm-hmm. you see a urogynecologist or somebody else?
So I would start with a general OBGYN. So I am not a urogynecologist, but I
okay.
end up doing
yeah.
a lot of pelvic floor. I'm just a general OBGYN. But I end up doing a lot of pelvic floor surgeries and evaluations and therapies myself. So I think you should be able to start with just your general OBGYN.
Okay.
And then kind of depending
okay.
on what's
then
going
what?
On.
Yeah.
Yeah, they might want a urogyn or they might want a general surgeon, or hopefully they can manage it themselves.
Okay.
So a urogyno is someone who would be knowledgeable about
yes.
erectile
Yeah, that's
prolapse.
Also a good option. Yes.
All right, Betsy, thanks a lot for the call. 800-348-2551 is our number. Nehemiah writes in, question about pap tests. What is the recommended protocol for routine pap testing for young women who are fully HPV vaccinated and gay, therefore not having intimate relations with men? And that's from Nehemiah.
We still start with pap testing for cervical cancer screening at age 21, and your first couple of paps should be done every 3 years with a cytology-based pap testing, which means actual cells brushed off the cervix. And then after age 30, we add in the HPV viral testing as well. And that's because we know young women, teenagers, and in their 20s, just statistically, get HPV and then clear it. So we don't want to test them for HPV. It comes back positive. We end up doing these biopsies, and then a year later it's gone, and we've put them through it. Sexual preferences don't really impact cervical cancer screening because you can still carry, transmit HPV, whether you're having a female partner or a male partner.
So you said there's the cytology pap, and that's the first one done.
Yeah.
And then there is a viral one. Is that a blood test?
No. So it's the viral testing, the HPV testing, is run from the cells that are brushed off the cervix. So
okay.
it's the same exam, the speculum exam, the
right.
little ducky thing, and the same little brush.
Is that what you call it in the office?
Yes.
Get the ducky thing. All right.
And the same brush getting cells off of the cervix, but there's just two components to the testing.
Gotcha.
The lab does that, not me.
Dr. Laura Twist is our guest today from New Vance Health. And let's go to Woodstock. Ray, you're on.
Yeah, how you doing? It's got a quick question.
Sure.
How common or necessary are amniocentesis tests done these days?
So amnios are much, much less common recently. This is actually a good update in OB care. We now have an option of doing, it's called NIPT or NIPS, NIPS testing. It's amazing technology. So once you're about 9-10 weeks pregnant, the mother has enough of fetal cells in her peripheral blood that you can take a sample of mom's blood and get fetal DNA.
Ooh.
Which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
It's
is that standard now?
So traditionally it was offered only to high-risk patients, advanced maternal age, where you have an increased risk of chromosome disorders or a personal history, family history. But now that testing is recommended and is offered to all pregnant women. I encourage my patients to get it done. Because of that, it is a screening test, NIPS, right? Non-invasive prenatal screening. An amniocentesis or a chorionic villus sampling, CVS, those are diagnostic tests. That's where we're taking cells like from placental tissue, or an amnio is taking fetal skin cells.
And is that
cells.
The one with the long needle that looks so horrifying?
Yes. So the amniocentesis is where you put a little needle through mom's pregnant belly, and you get cells, fetal cells, directly from the amniotic fluid.
That's painful,
around
right?
baby. Yeah, it's not pleasant. It has some risk because you are putting a little needle through the uterine wall, some infection risk. But, I mean, everything's done as safely as possible. But it's certainly less common now that those blood tests, screening tests, which are very accurate, as they are more common, more widely available for patients.
Ray, thanks for the call. Let's go to Jill in Hillsdale. Jill, you're on.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, Jill.
Oh, it's Jill, not Jill.
Oh, sorry, John.
No, that's all right. People don't always understand me on the phone. I'm calling because I have a daughter who has serious endometriosis. And she was treated. The endometria were removed with an operation. They were outside of her uterus. Have you treated endometriosis?
Yes. So endometriosis comes in kind of all these different sizes. Some people have a little bit of endometriosis, but a lot of symptoms. And it can be, it's sort of like endometrial tissue, which is the lining of the uterus, like sprinkles all over the pelvis. And so then normally every month your hormones feed the uterine lining and it sheds off, and that's what makes period. But if these little implants are on your ovaries or on your tubes or on your bowel, anywhere in your pelvis, they're still responding to hormones, swelling and bleeding, but there's sort of no escape or outlet for that blood. So they create a cycle of inflammation and pain. It's rather unpleasant for most people. So for a surgery, I think what you said is that they removed her endometriomas, which is what we call it when the endometriosis makes basically a bloody cyst on the ovary. And we do that with laparoscopy. I've done that with straight stick laparoscopy or with the robot. And that usually provides relief. The surgical excision and removing the implants provides relief for some amount of time. It's hard to know if it might be 2 years, 10 years before these implants kind of build back up again and create symptoms again. We can use progesterone usually to kind of help keep them at bay. Progesterone is that hormone.
Yeah, what does that do?
That it's the hormone that balances estrogen. So it helps to shrink those little implants and hopefully make them go all the way away. So that can be oral progesterone or a progesterone IUD, like a Mirena IUD. Yeah.
She is being treated with infusions every 6 weeks, and they say this will have to be for the rest of her life.
Okay, infusions for the rest of her life.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not sure what she's getting infusions of, if they're for like iron because she's bleeding heavily, or for pain management.
It's tough
I'm
to diagnose
sure.
all this stuff on the phone when you don't have all the details. All right, Jill, we're going to have to leave it there. We're just about out of time,
but thanks
for the call. You know, it strikes me that you're in almost the miracle business, Dr. Twist. And to me, the whole life cycle, the birth cycle, is so magical. Yet it's your job. Do you still see the magic in it?
Oh, yeah. Yes. It's the best. Having a patient that you've met with, you know, 20 times over the course of 2 years as they're over many years trying to get pregnant, or like trying to avoid pregnancy, then trying to get pregnant, then pregnant, and then you finally get to deliver their baby and you watch their family. It's fantastic. It's a wonderful thing to be part of.
Well, we just delivered this baby. The show's over. And hey, Dr. Laura Twist, heck of a job. Thanks for coming.
Thanks. Thank you.
Support comes from Upstate Dermatology for more than 30 years, providing medical and surgical dermatology services, including Mohs surgery with 5 locations in the Capital Region and Western Massachusetts, upstatederm.com. Thanks again to Dr. Laura Twist of New Vance Health for being here today. Thank you for calling. Sorry if we didn't get to your question. We will do this topic again at some point soon. Thanks to Zachary Malloy, our engineer. Bob Rathman screened the calls. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow on the program, we will, it's spring, right? Almost. It'll be spring soon enough. We'll talk weather with News Channel 13 meteorologist Radar Reed Kisselback. That's tomorrow at 2. We'll see you then.